the Maker. He had never dwelled on memory's delights. Impressions slid over him, vivid but ephemeral. A potter's vermilion, the heavens laden with stars that were also gods, the moon from which a lion had fallen, the slick feel of marble beneath slow sensitive fingertips, the taste of wild boar meat eagerly torn by his white teeth, a Phoenician word, the black shadow a lance casts on yellow sand, the nearness of the sea or of a woman, a heavy wine, its roughness cut by honey. These could fill his soul completely. He knew what terror was, but he also knew anger and rage, and once he had been the first to scale an enemy wall. Eager, curious, casual, with no other law than fulfillment and the immediate indifference that ensues, he walked the varied earth and saw, on one seashore or another, the cities of men and their palaces. In crowded marketplaces or at the foot of a mountain whose uncertain peak might be inhabited by satyrs, he had listened to complicated tales which he accepted, as he accepted reality, without asking whether they were true or false. Gradually now, the beautiful universe was slipping away from him. A stubborn mist erased the outline of his hand. The night was no longer peopled by stars. The earth beneath his feet was unsure. Everything was growing distant and blurred. When he knew he was going blind, he cried out. Stoic modesty had not yet been invented, and Hector could flee with impunity. I will not see again, he felt, either the sky filled with mythical dread, or this face that the years will transform. Over this desperation of his flesh passed days and nights. But one morning he awoke. He looked, no longer alarmed, at the dim things that surrounded him. And inexplicably he sensed, as one recognizes a tune or a voice, that now it was over and that he had faced it, with fear but also with joy, hope, and curiosity. Then he descended into his memory, which seemed to him endless, and up from that vertigo he succeeded in bringing forth a forgotten recollection that shone like a coin under the rain, perhaps because he had never looked at it, unless in a dream. The recollection was like this. Another boy had insulted him, and he had run to his father and told him about it. His father let him talk as if he were not listening or did not understand, and he took down from the wall a bronze dagger, beautiful and charged with power, which the boy had secretly coveted. Now he had it in his hands, and the surprise of possession obliterated the affront he had suffered. But his father's voice was saying, "Let someone know you are a man," and there was a command in his voice. The night blotted out the paths. Clutching the dagger, in which he felt the foreboding of a magic power, he descended the rough hillside that surrounded the house and ran to the seashore, dreaming he was Ajax and Perseus, and peopling the salty darkness with battles and wounds. The exact taste of that moment was what he was seeking now. The rest did not matter. The insults of the duel, the rude combat, the return home with the bloody blade. Another memory, in which there was also a knight and an imminence of adventure, sprang out of that one. A woman, the first the gods had set aside for him, had waited for him in the shadow of a hypogeum, and he had searched for her through the corridors that were like stone nets, along slopes that sank into the shadow. Why did those memories come back to him? And why did they come without bitterness, as a mere foreshadowing of the present? In grave amazement, he understood. In this night, too, in this night of his mortal eyes into which he was now descending, love and danger were again waiting, Ares and Aphrodite, for already he divined, Already it encircled him. A murmur of glory and hexameters. A murmur of men defending a temple the gods will not save, and of black vessels searching the sea for a beloved isle. The murmur of the Odysseys and Iliads it was his destiny to sing and leave echoing concavely in the memory of man. These things we know, but not those that he felt when he descended into the last shade of all. Dream Tigers. In my childhood, I was a fervent worshiper of the tiger. Not the jaguar, the spotted tiger of the Amazonian tangles, but the striped, Asiatic, royal tiger that can be faced only by a man of war, on a castle, atop an elephant. I used to linger endlessly before one of the cages at the zoo. I judged vast encyclopedias and books of natural history by the splendor of their tigers. I still remember those illustrations. I, who cannot rightly remember the brow or the smile of a woman. Childhood passed away, and the tigers and my passion for them grew old, but they are still in my dreams. At that submerged or chaotic level, they keep prevailing. And so, as I sleep, some dream beguiles me. And suddenly I know I am dreaming. Then I think, this is a dream, a pure diversion of my will. And now that I have unlimited power, I am going to cause a tiger. Oh, incompetence! Never can my dreams engender the wild beast I long for. The tiger indeed appears, but stuffed or flimsy, or with impure variations of shape, or of an implausible size, or all too fleeting, or with the touch of the dog or the bird. Parable of the Palace. That day, the yellow emperor showed the poet his palace. They left behind, in long succession, the first terraces on the west which descend, like the steps of an almost measureless amphitheater, to a paradise or garden, whose metal mirrors and intricate juniper hedges already prefigured the labyrinth. They lost themselves in it, gaily at first, as if condescending to play a game, but afterwards not without misgiving, for its straight avenues were subject to a curvature, ever so slight, but continuous, and secretly those avenues were circles. Toward midnight, observation of the planets and the opportune sacrifice of a turtle permitted them to extricate themselves from that seemingly bewitched region, but not from the sense of being lost. For this accompanied them to the end. Foyers and patios and libraries they traversed then, and a hexagonal room, the Clepsydra, and one morning from a tower they descried a stone man, whom they then lost sight of forever. Many shining rivers did they cross in sandalwood canoes, or a single river many times. The imperial retinue would pass and people would prostrate themselves, but one day they put in on an island where someone did not, because he had never seen the Son of Heaven, and the executioner had to decapitate him. Black heads of hair and black dances and complicated golden masks did their eyes indifferently behold, the real and the dream to became one. or rather reality was one of dreams' configurations. It seemed impossible that the Earth were anything but gardens, pools, architectures, and splendorous forms. Every 100 paces, a tower cleft the air. To the eye, their color was identical, yet the first of all was yellow, and the last, scarlet. So delicate were the gradations, and so long the series. It was at the foot of the next to the last tower that the poet, who was as if untouched by the wonders that amazed the rest, recited the brief composition we find today indissolubly linked to his name, and which, as the more elegant historians have it, gave him immortality and death. The text has been lost. There are some who contend it consisted of a single line. Others say it had but a single word. The truth, the incredible truth, is that in the poem stood the enormous palace, entire and minutely detailed, with each illustrious porcelain, and every sketch on every porcelain, and the shadows, and the light of the twilights, and each unhappy or joyous moment of the glorious dynasties of mortals, gods, and dragons who had dwelled in it from the interminable past. All fell silent, but the emperor exclaimed, "You have robbed me of my palace!" And the executioner's iron sword cut the poet down. Others tell the story differently. There cannot be any two things alike in the world. The poet, they say, had only to utter the poem to make the palace disappear, as if abolished and blown to bits by the final syllable. Such legends, of course, amount to no more than literary fiction. The poet was a slave of the emperor, and as such, he died. His composition sank into oblivion because it deserved oblivion, and his descendants still seek, nor will they find, the one word that contains the universe. And I. It's the other one, it's Borges, that things happen to. I stroll about Buenos Aires and stop, perhaps mechanically now, to look at the arch of an entrance or an iron gate. News of Borges reaches me through the mail, and I see his name on an academic ballot or in a biographical dictionary. I like hourglasses, maps, 18th century typography, the taste of coffee, and Stevenson's prose. The other one shares these preferences with me, but in a vain way that converts them into the attributes of an actor. It would be too much to say that our relations are hostile. I live, I allow myself to live, so that Borges may contrive his literature. And that literature justifies my existence. I do not mind confessing that he has managed to write some worthwhile pages, but those pages cannot save me, perhaps because the good part no longer belongs to anyone, not even to the other one, but rather to the Spanish language or to tradition. Otherwise, I am destined to be lost, definitively, and only a few instants of me will be able to survive in the other one. Little by little, I am yielding him everything, although I am well aware of his perverse habit of falsifying and exaggerating. Spinoza held that all things long to preserve their old nature. The rock wants to be a rock forever and the tiger a tiger. But I must live on in Borges, not in myself, if indeed I am anyone, though I recognize myself less in his books than in many others. or than in the laborious strumming of a guitar. Years ago, I tried to free myself from him, and I passed from lower class myths to playing games with time and infinity. But those games are Borges's now, and I will have to conceive something else. Thus my life is running away, and I lose everything, and everything belongs to oblivion, or to the other one. I do not know which of us two is writing this page.